Good morning. It's my pleasure to introduce our first panel today, Loyal Deserters, Unionist Confederates, and Vigilante Law, Reexamining Communal Violence and Memory in the Upper South. I'm glad that so many of you are here on Saturday. This is great. It's nice that the conference that I helped organize is actually a reality, and it's been a great paper so far, so we're going to see three more great papers today in this session. I'll introduce the presenters, and then I'll introduce the commentator after the presenters have done their dirty work. Our first presenter is Leonard Lanier. He's the assistant curator of the Museum of the Albemarle, where he has worked since 2011. He earned a BA from East Carolina University in 2005, and he is presently a graduate student at Louisiana State University. His paper this morning is entitled Killing the Klansman, Remembering the General, The Opposing Memories of Brian Grimes. Our second presenter is Adam Dolby. He's a PhD candidate at U.S. history at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, where he gives out A's to any student athlete who shows up.
They don't have to show up.
That's true. So for the last 15 years, my wife, who has a PhD from the University of North Carolina, has told me how good her degree is compared to my crappy degree from University of Florida. She's heard a lot this week, let me just say. He earned his MA from the University of North Carolina in 2011 and his BA from Yale University, a real university, in 2006. I'll stop. He has won a number of prestigious research grants, including a Mellon Fellowship from the Virginia Historical Society, and has published articles in Traces and a number of online outlets, which I won't go in because they had long titles and I couldn't figure out what the full real title was, so I won't tell you the names, but they're online. It's got interesting stuff on there. His paper today is entitled Loyal Dissenters, The Memory of Desertion and Dissent in Piedmont, North Carolina. And our third presenter is Matthew Hulbert. He is a PhD candidate in U.S. history at the University of Georgia and the Special Projects Manager for Civil War Monitor. He is the author of a number of articles in various outlets, including Commonplace, Civil War History, The Journal of the West, and the Journal of the Civil War Era. And he's also made two contributions to the New York Times Opinionator Disunion column, the first in August 2013, and most recently this month. Has it come out yet?
It should come out tomorrow.
Oh, cool. That's really cool kind of Civil War column, and there's an actually nice compilation of the first couple, I think 3 years of articles from the Disunion Opinionator. It's really interesting stuff is on there. So that's Matthew Hulbert is our third expert presenter, and I'll turn it over to Leonard. Thanks.
I just want to say thank you to the Filson for allowing us to. Adam and I have been trying to get this panel together for about 3 years now, and we've submitted it several times, and finally we get a conference that accepts the panel. So that was great. On April 9th, 1905, a large crowd gathered just outside a small railroad town in Southside, Virginia. They assembled around two large stone panels shipped all the way from the mountains of North Carolina. 3 years earlier, the General Assembly of the Old Norse State appropriated the money for a grand monument at the site of Robert E. Lee's surrender near Appomattox Courthouse. With the memorial now finished and installed, the North Carolina chapter of the United Orders of the Confederacy arranged a grand dedication ceremony. Precisely at noon, on the 40th anniversary of Lee's surrender, the governors of North Carolina and Virginia pulled the covers off a $5,000 monument. They revealed an inscription, first at Bethel, farthest at Gettysburg and Chickamauga, last at Appomattox. Walter Clark, the former Confederate officer turned unofficial state historian of North Carolina, frequently referenced the phrase as our Civil War motto. The words alluded to three common held beliefs about North Carolina's role in the bloody conflict. As a wave of Confederate nostalgia rushed over the state in the 1880s, North Carolinians frequently claimed that their soldiers suffered the first war casualties, made the deepest penetration of the Union lines during Pickett's charge, and launched the final attempt to break free from Grant's encircling army at Appomattox. 40 years later, a crowd returned to the very spot to mark that event. The General Assembly felt so strongly about the claim that the legislature ordered that the new monument contain the phrase. despite the utmost assurances of North Carolina's elected representatives, the accuracy of first at Bethel, farthest at Gettysburg and Chickamauga, last at Appomattox, remained a matter of much contention. The phrase played a leading role in the infamous dispute between North Carolina and Virginia over their respective states' contributions to the Confederate war effort. The controversy even raised its head at the monument dedication in 1905. After Virginia Governor Andrew Jackson Montague accepted the North Carolina UDC's invitation to the dedication ceremony, Richmond newspapers attacked the North Carolina claim. They charged that Virginia troops made the final effort. In his time of greatest need, the Richmond Times-Dispatch editorialized, General Lee naturally turned to the soldiers of his home state for aid. Even some in North Carolina had their doubts. The namesake son of General Daniel Harvey Hill, who was a prominent official in the Democratic Party and a longtime administrator at North Carolina State Agricultural College, now NC State, acknowledged that we may never know who gave that last sacrifice for our glorious cause. Speaking directly about the Appomattox Monument, Hill made a further revealing statement. This whole affair belongs to Grimes. Hill meant John Bryan Grimes, commonly referred to as J. Bryan Grimes. An up-and-comer within the state Democratic Party, J. Bryan Grimes won election as North Carolina's Secretary of State before he turned 30. As a former state legislator, Grimes helped guide the build for the Appomattox Monument through the General Assembly. His crucial role earned Grimes a highly sought-after spot at the dedication ceremony. The erection of the North Carolina Monument at Appomattox culminated J. Bryan Grimes' personal crusade. His father, General Bryan Grimes, commanded the assault at Appomattox that North Carolinians now looked back to with so much pride. Following the general's death, his son embarked on a campaign to protect and defend his father's legacy. Through speeches, editorials, and books, J. Bryan Grimes trumped his father's role in the Civil War. By 1905, General Grimes held a place of high honor among North Carolina's Confederate pantheon, someone worthy of a grand monument paid for by state tax dollars. Now, after more than 20 years of toil, the new memorial marked the capstone of J. Bryan Grimes' efforts. Following the celebration at Appomattox, he wrote a short note to his brother, Junius Daniel, or J.D. Grimes, expressing his sense of fulfillment. Our work is done, dear brother. Father's memory will live on, no matter what they say. What they had to say was a lot, for despite the family's attempts to cleanse and purify the story, General Bryan Grimes left a battered public legacy behind for his children. During the Civil War, a majority of fellow officers regarded Grimes as nothing more than a political hack. According to one detractor, the former Pitt County planner owed his promotion to the simple fact that better men kept dying in front of him. Grimes's naive efforts to reach political office, both during and after the war, did not further his reputation. Invoking his Confederate credentials to legitimize white resistance to Reconstruction, Grimes failed to effectively dominate his own county. As a further injury, or final injury, the former general died in an inglorious ambush, victim of assailants unknown. While tragic, the circumstances surrounding his death gave Grimes's memory new life. In the capable hands of close friends, his wife and eldest son, General Bryan Grimes emerged as the glorious Confederate warrior cut down in the prime of life, instead of the balding, overweight, middle-aged, heavily indebted, unsuccessful politician of reality. In their greatest act of myth-making, the family even succeeded in almost airbrushing out Grimes's leading role in the North Carolina Ku Klux Klan. The Grimes family possessed personal reasons for these acts of memory management. They obviously wanted to show the general in the greatest positive light. J. Bryan Grimes, though, had an even greater reason to inflate his father's importance. Through the effective public manipulation of his father's demise and his Confederate career, J. Bryan Grimes forged a political career that lasted over 40 years. The family completed their work so well that only now can historians begin to separate the man from the myth. Bryan Grimes possessed a notable background. His grandfather served in the Revolution, and his father, who was also called Bryan Grimes, served continuously as a state senator from Pitt County from 1840 to his death in 1860. And I guess before I go any further, I will point out, if you're unfamiliar with North Carolina geography, the two counties I'm going to focus on for the rest of the talk, this is Beaufort here, and Pitt County, which would have been home to the Grimes family and their large farm. And notice the difference in the slave population from Beaufort County and Pitt County. Although by Deep South standards, the Grimeses barely attained planter status, they bombastically referred to their large farm as Grimesland. The family assumed the mantle of the Southern aristocracy, but with considerable friction. Although they lived in Pitt County, land ownership, shipping connections, and simple geography tied the clan to adjacent Beaufort County, a district composed almost entirely of yeomen and middling farmers. The family cultivated animosity, not love, amongst their neighbors. Local merchants and artisans complained that Senator Grimes is a little high-handed and expects the highest sales and the lowest prices. His son, the future general, aggravated this situation through his attempts to wield political influence as a secessionist Democrat in a Whig county. Grimes and a small but extremely loyal group of associates stayed on the fringes of political opinion until the spring of 1861. In eastern North Carolina, as elsewhere in the state, once Abraham Lincoln called for troops, the Unionist majority collapsed. His long-held support for disunion earned Grimes a seat at the political table. Pitt County elected him as a delegate to the secession convention, and his ally, William Blunt Rodman, won election in Beaufort County. Following the unanimous vote to leave the Union, Governor John W. Ellis commissioned Grimes as a colonel. The devout secessionist, however, possessed bigger aspirations. While his regiment trained for battle, Grimes asked allies, including his father, to solicit a promotion to Brigadier General from Ellis. In a letter to William Augustus Blunt II, who was a significant Eastern politician, Ellis aired his reservations about Grimes, since he does not possess any martial experience in the field of war. The absorption of North Carolina's troops into the Confederate military structure made the matter moot, but the affair hinged at things that would continue to pop up in Grimes's career, military career. Considering his level of inexperience, over the next 4 years, Grimes developed a solid reputation as a Confederate officer. Writing not long after the war ended, Jubal Early, who commanded Grimes during the 1864 Valley Campaign, called the North Carolinian a reputable, though not brilliant, officer. A capable leader, he did everything that I asked of him. Other officers took a slightly dimmer view, describing Grimes as a good man, but too occupied with other concerns, namely politics. Grimes caused considerable outrage amongst his regiment when he was a colonel in 1862 when he attempted to take over the state Senate seat that had been recently occupied by his now deceased father. Riding home, a corporal from Jones County in North Carolina mentioned, "All the talk lately is of the old man leaving us for the state house. While we fight and die, he'll be smoking big cigars and drinking whiskey." Vocal opposition led Grimes to refuse the office, but damage to his reputation refused to heal. Although he eventually rose to the rank of Major General, Grimes never escaped the label of political appointee. After the war, Grimes aimed to create a local power base in the eastern half of North Carolina. As he revealed to his lieutenants, the former general felt that our recent service will do us well. If Grimes counted on widespread sympathies for the defeated Confederacy, however, he gravely mistook local public opinion. In 1862, the Union had seized a large portion of coastal North Carolina. In Beaufort County, the federal victories resurrected Unionist feelings amongst the white population. Residents of Washington, the county seat of Beaufort County, welcomed occupying Massachusetts troops with a large banner inscribed, "The Union and Constitution Forever." Local men deserted Confederate regiments in massive numbers, forcing two companies to consolidate into other unions. Southern commanders launched three campaigns to retake the county and win the populace back to their side, but harsh treatment at the hands of Confederate troops pushed sentiments even further toward the Union. As Grimes and his companions quickly discovered, Southern appeals did not even work on former Confederate soldiers. Responding to an offer to join the Democrats, a Confederate veteran serving as the Republican town sheriff in Washington told a Grimes ally that you people started this damn war, and I'm glad it's over. Unsuccessful in courting their former comrades, Grimes quickly resorted to violence. By early 1868, he had organized the local chapter of the Ku Klux Klan. In both Pitt and Beaufort counties, Grimes targeted freedmen and their white allies. The Republicans retaliated with both physical and legal action. Mysterious fire struck a turpentine warehouse and a bridge owned by Grimes. The local Superior Court judge, a man derisively labeled J. Bird Jones by Democratic sympathizers, threw Klansmen in jail, including Grimes' associate Joseph John, or J.J. Laughinghouse. When Grimes threatened the judge during a session of the court, Jones levied a $500 fine against the former general. The threats and violence failed to achieve their ultimate objective, the removal of Republican-controlled county government. Only in 1875, when the state legislature made all county offices appointed rather than elected, did the Democrats seize control of the levers of power in both Pitt and Beaufort counties. Redemption could not end the violence, however. If anything, Democratic domination raised the level of attacks by both sides. The Democrats feared any large gathering by Republicans and openly used force to break them up. Republicans retaliated by striking the foremost symbol of Democratic rule, the economic power of leaders like Grimes and Laughinghouse. Over an 8-year period, both men suffered the combined losses by fire of 1 cotton gin, 2 tobacco barns, a grist mill, all by culprits unknown. The summer of 1880 proved especially horrendous. In late June, near Falkland in northern Pitt County, Democrats killed 3 black Republicans at a political barbecue. 3 days later, a barn at Laughinghouse's farm and the replacement grist mill at Grimesland both went up in flames. The sheriff arrested one of Grimes's black tenant farmers, a man by the name of Romeo Saddlewhite, for the mill fire. The very next night, July the 19th, a crowd of white and black ruffians broke into the Pitt County Jail, grabbed Saddlewhite, took him to the train station, and put him on the next train for Baltimore. Infuriated at Saddlewhite's escape, Grimes threatened to sue 2 leading white Republicans for the loss of his mill. On July 29th, members of Laughinghouse's family began reporting signs consistent with arsenic poisoning. J.J. Laughinghouse immediately accused the same 2 Republicans, William B. and Howell Perrymore, of trying to kill him. With all this drama unfolding around him, Grimes attended Beaufort County's Democratic Party convention on August the 14th. That night, as his wagon crossed a local creek on the way back to his farm at Grimesland, a rifle shot ended the life of Brian Grimes. At the time of his earthly demise, local people may have commonly referred to him as the General, but Grimes's military reputation rarely entered into the conversation. As the trial of his accused killer approached, regional newspapers acknowledged local feelings of anger toward Grimes and his cohort. A Richmond paper aligned with Virginia's Republican movement candidly admitted that although a majority disapproves of the ghastly way that General Grimes died, none appear especially disheartened or saddened by his death. In the words of one trial bystander that was recorded by the newly founded Raleigh News and Observer, quote, "The old son of a bitch got what he deserved. I wish I had bushwhacked him myself." Low opinion of Grimes even impacted the trial. The first attempt to try the accused ended in a mistrial after an elderly juror, Asa Pinkham, suffered heart palpitations. Before the judge arranged a new court date, the prosecution asked that the trial move to another county. Since the animosity toward the recently deceased, this is in the words of the trial judge, since the animosity toward the recently deceased prevents the state from getting a fair hearing in this county, Judge David Schnick moved the case to neighboring Martin County. In June 1881, the murder trial of William Parker, Grimes' accused killer, got underway. After 3 months of fruitless searching, authorities suddenly arrested Parker in November of 1880 and charged him with the crime. In his diary, Judge Schnick suggested that the county sheriff selected Parker as the culprit because he and his father are, quote, damn Republicans. The state's case against him relied heavily on circumstantial evidence, including a supposed jailhouse confession heard by another prisoner. James E. Shepard, the local lawyer hired by Parker's father to defend the 21-year-old farm laborer, easily identified the logical holes in the prosecutor's argument. Shepard, a moderate Democrat, felt so strongly about his client's innocence that he did not even bother to call his own witnesses. In closing argument, Shepard announced that Thomas Sparrow, the lawyer hired by Grimes' family to aid the prosecution, had no weapon, no gun, and therefore no case. The democratically aligned state papers, however, firmly believed in Parker's guilt. The Raleigh News and Observer believed that the jury will quickly sentence this fiend to death. However, after 2 hours of deliberation, the 12 men found Parker not guilty of the crime. The news shocked the state's conservative elite. In their eyes, evidence of Parker's guilt appeared overwhelming. The newspapers quickly assumed that only a conspiracy led by Shepard could explain this verdict. The News and Observer singled out the two black jurors, accusing them of taking money from Shepard. When the paper uncovered no evidence to support this claim, it switched the accusations to the other 10 men on the panel. An investigation by the Martin County Sheriff revealed nothing to support any charges of witness or jury tampering. After a few weeks of sensational headlines, the entire episode quickly faded from public view. However, a vocal minority refused to let the issue die. Grimes' family and his close associates stood at the forefront of this effort. "We cannot let this good man's reputation remain tarnished," J.J. Laughinghouse wrote to Grimes' widow, Charlotte. "I aim to do anything in my power to correct this injustice," he further stated. Laughinghouse knew that the Grimes supporters faced an uphill battle to win over public opinion. "The people believe that your dearest husband was a bully, but we know differently," he wrote in a letter to Charlotte Grimes. Laughinghouse then asked whether the widow Grimes possessed any writings or correspondence that reflect a good nature or the good character of that noble soul. She responded that, "Yes, I have in my possession some of the letters that the general sent to me during the war." Laughinghouse immediately offered to help Charlotte Grimes locate a publisher in Raleigh for a collection of these important writings. In the spring of 1883, Edwards and Broughton published a slim volume entitled Abstracts of the Letters of Major General Grimes to His Wife, written while in active service in the Army of Northern Virginia, together with some personal recollections of the war. And since I only have 2 minutes left, I'll kind of briefly synopsize how the publication of this particular volume is the beginning of a concerted effort by Grimes, his foremost supporter, Laughinghouse, who had served with him in the Klan, and his eldest son, J. Bryan Grimes, to use the literature of the Lost Cause and also the political aspirations of not only J. Bryan Grimes, but of James E. Shepard, the lawyer who had defended Parker in the trial. They used these particular two-pronged approach, both the politics and the literature, to elevate Grimes' reputation, which had been so severely tarnished by the time he actually passed away, to elevate him to this pantheon. And of course, the paper, which is posted online, goes into this more in depth. So I'll quickly, since my time is limited, go straight to my conclusion here, if I can find the right page. In letters to his brother, J. Bryan Grimes hoped that our work will last till time immemorial. Like the Lost Cause in general, the celebratory version of General Bryan Grimes remained powerful for over 150 years. Only in recent times have historians and scholars began to question the family's interpretation of their illustrious forebearer. This reflects a wider movement to reappraise the war and Reconstruction in coastal North Carolina. Works by Judkin Browning and others take issue with the traditional view of Eastern North Carolina as a solid bastion of Southern sympathies and white supremacy. Browning also confronts a mountain of myth and legend, as well as other authors who have written recently on the subject. Studying the past also means an examination of the ways that people construct their memories of the past. With regard to Bryan Grimes, public memory chose to kill the Klansman and remember the general. Thank you.
Which is
the corners on the stand
right here. the border of Davidson and Forsyth County. So we'll be moving westward, not quite where most of the other papers have been occurring, but you know, a little bit farther to the west. Pointer's right here. It's right there. Davidson Forsyth border is where we'll be situating ourselves. I want to thank everyone for coming. Thank you, Barton, for being our commentator. Thank you for the gracious introduction. I appreciate it. Thanks to both the other panelists with me. So, without further ado, I'll go ahead and jump on in. At around 2 p.m. on an April afternoon, shots rang out along the northern border of Davidson County, North Carolina. A detail of Michigan cavalrymen traded rounds with a Confederate skirmish line. Sent to find horses to replace their company's exhausted mounts, the Michiganders found themselves cut off from their unit, which was about 7 miles to the north. The soldiers asked the passing farmer for a way around the Confederate forces, and for the first time, the farmer, Samuel D. Yokley, found himself in a position to contribute directly to the Union cause, a service he gladly provided. The soldiers used his directions and bypassed the enemy, but before riding off, they commandeered his horse and fired off a few shots at the Confederate soldiers. Whether their shots hit anyone remains unknown, but if any Confederates died, they did so needlessly. The word had not arrived. General Lee had surrendered the day before. As the Confederacy took its last breath, Union troops had finally arrived in Davidson County. The war, of course, had been there for much longer. Since 1861, Confederate loyalists and those opposed to secession fought an inner war in the Piedmont of North Carolina. Characterized by robberies, arsons, death threats, and bushwhackings, the violence had steadily increased over the course of the war. Local citizens fed deserters and hid escaped Union prisoners, while bands of deserters, recusant conscripts, the 19th century equivalent of a draft dodger, and other dissenters openly resisted Confederate authority. In 1863, an entire regiment of Confederate soldiers was sent to suppress dissent and scoured the woods around Yokley's homestead, hunting for deserters. Over the course of 2 months, the unit captured at least 3,000 deserters, and others died resisting. In March of 1865, General Lee dispatched a battalion of sharpshooters from his already strained Army of Northern Virginia to again suppress dissent and round up deserters. This unit consisted of men from the area, summarily executed 5 dissenters and sent 50 others back to the lines. Southern dissenters' self-proclaimed loyalty to the Union did not protect their property. Left with no horse and not even a receipt to show for it, Samuel Yokley walked home. A decade passed before he received any compensation for his property. In 1878, Yokley finally submitted his claim to the Southern Claims Commission for the horse taken by federal troops. Created in 1871, the commission allowed loyal Southerners to receive compensation for any property taken by Union forces. Commissioners examined written testimony as well as wartime documents to determine if claimants really remained loyal during the war. The government set an extremely high standard. Any aid given to the Confederacy, even if the alternative were death or bodily harm, resulted in a claims rejection. However, in 1878, Yokley's claim received approval, and he entered the history books as a certified Unionist. Neither the most transparent opportunist nor the most self-effacing claimant, Yokley and his family provide a window into the motives, means, and memories of dissent during the postbellum era. And we'll be spending the rest of the paper dealing solely with Yokley. The Yokley family's history hints additionally at why no lasting Unionist counter-narrative to the lost cause took hold in the Piedmont. The wartime complexity of dissent hampered efforts to create a lasting shared memory of dissent. Ultimately, the collective amnesia experienced by North Carolina was not solely a product of former Confederates writing the history. Indeed, wartime dissenters contributed to the erasure of their very dissent from the dominant narratives of the war. At first glance, one would have might have expected Yoakley to have been a secessionist. He was already prosperous in 1860. He owned multiple farmsteads, and he held stock in the North Carolina Railroad, and with 14 slaves, he was heavily invested in the South's peculiar institution. However, Yoakley, a pre-war Whig, vocally opposed secession, correctly believing it would result in the end of slavery. The Yoakley family was never enthusiastic about the Confederacy, and they belonged to a substantial portion of the Piedmont's population that remained unconvinced of the need for a new nation. As the war developed, their opinion of the Confederacy only diminished. Because of the complexity of wartime loyalties, I will be using the term dissenter where others might use unionist. Dissenter encompasses anyone who resisted Confederate authority at any point in the war. Dissenters include volunteers who deserted after a year of service, as well as members of the Home Guard, responsible for hunting deserters during much of the war, who later fled to northern lines when ordered to the front themselves in October of 1864. They were very principled folks. Dissenters as a term, though, does not presume to define motivations. Unionism, in contrast, implies a political ideology as the basis for dissenters' resistance to the Confederacy. So for today, I'll be using the term unionist to refer instead to the post-war identity claimed by many wartime dissenters. And though love of union surely played a role in many of their decisions, patriotism was frequently only one of many motives. Religion, family obligation, kinship, as well as pragmatic self-interest all influenced dissenters' decisions and actions. Dissenters' approaches to resisting the Confederacy were as wide as their motivations. Within the Yoakley family, a range of strategies of dissent can be found. During the first year of the war, many families, less supportive of the Confederacy, went about their lives with relatively few major disruptions. However, the advent of conscription pushed even the most ambivalent citizen into taking a stance on the war. Too old to serve himself, Samuel Yoakley watched as the Confederacy conscripted two of his six sons, as well as his younger brother. Within a month, however, all three conscripts deserted and returned home to hide in the woods, being the loyal Confederates they were. One of them eventually fled to northern lines, and a third son, who had left home for Missouri before the war, died in federal service. Additionally, Samuel's fourth son became a recusant conscript, joining his brothers in the woods during the latter part of the wars. Another of Samuel's brothers, Andrew, initially hired a substitute to avoid service. When the Confederate Congress repealed the rule allowing substitutes, he arranged for himself a detail to haul wood for the railroad. Only when this exemption became too costly did Andrew join his nephews in the woods. The Yoakley family then included deserters, recusant conscripts, detailed workers, and a federal volunteer. And all of these individuals considered themselves and each other Union men, and their community largely agreed. Samuel Yoakley's testimony to the Southern Claims Commission after the war reveals a traumatic wartime experience that exacerbated his initial disaffection for the Confederacy. Now, for starters, the Confederate loyalist threatened to burn his home because his boys would not fight for the Confederacy, and he protected them. In addition to these threats, Confederate troops arrested him three times. Each time, they eventually freed him, but the experience bred resentment, of course. In the fall of 1863, Captain John Gilmore of the 21st North Carolina arrested Yoakley in an attempt to force his sons to return to service. Yoakley, wearing only one layer, later recalled how the Confederates would not allow him to go back home for his coat, spent a cold night under arrest at a local school, at which point he refused to accompany the soldiers any farther. According to Yoakley, the 22-year-old captain ordered a portion of his men to shoot him. They surrounded him and presented their guns at him. Yoakley called his bluff, though, and told the brash young soldier, "If you kill me, you will only have one old man out of the way." After a few minutes, Gilmore and his men left, leaving Yoakley alone in the school. Yoakley was extremely lucky. The 21st North Carolina killed multiple dissenters during their unit's sweep of the Piedmont for deserters. Yoakley's experiences, though, engendered no affection for the Confederacy. They intensified his allegiance to the Union. As the Yoakley's response suggests, though, conscription may have created more Union men than any other act of the Confederate government, including secession. Yokley's third arrest for hiding his sons resulted in a revealing conversation regarding the roots of his resistance. After a night in the Forsyth County Courthouse without anything to eat, Samuel was dragged before an enrolling officer who announced his intent to enroll Yokley's youngest son. Yokley declared that his son did not belong to the Confederate service as he was only 16 years old, and he threatened to spend, and I quote, spend the last dollar, the last nigger, and the last horse before they should have him. Central to his resistance was protecting his son, which is key. Upon learning that Yokley owned slaves, though, the enrollment officer asked the farmer why he failed to support the Confederacy. Yokley replied that if I had lived under the government of the United States and its Constitution, and that government has always protected me and my property. The character of Yokley's resistance largely evolved not from patriotism, but from family loyalty. Though willing to give anything for his son, he was less willing to give his last dollar, last slave, or horse for the Union. In fact, the day after Federal cavalry took his horse, Yokley attempted to protest to the unit's commander and retrieve his animal, but the troops had left the area before he reached their encampment. Still, the constant harassment and mistreatment by Confederate authorities ensured that by 1865, Yokley identified more strongly with the Union than the Confederacy. Ideology and loyalty, though, are always fluid. There were limits to the Yokley's love of the flag, as well as tangible reasons for their allegiance to the Union. For the Yokley's, dissent remained, though, I want to be clear, first and foremost about protecting their family, and secondly, preserving their property. A sense of patriotism almost certainly contributed additional motivation, but self-interest determined the manner of dissent. Unlike some dissenters who attacked the farms of secessionists and officers in the Home Guard to intimidate them, the Yokley sought to avoid conflict. For most of the war, the Yokley's resistance consisted of avoiding service and helping others on the run. The family never attacked the Confederate war effort directly. They didn't cut a rail line. They didn't burn a bridge. They didn't attack a supply wagon. However, in 1864, one of Samuel's sons was captured by the Home Guard, and the Yokley boys took up arms. As the Confederate squad escorted the three prisoners with their hands tied behind their back along the plank road connecting Salem to High Point, around a dozen dissenters ambushed the soldiers. The prisoners were soon cut loose and set at liberty. Leading the rescue party was none other than Samuel Yokley. Other rescuers included neighbors and at least one of Samuel's sons. The goal of this attack was not to bring about the fall of the Confederacy, though the perpetrators eagerly awaited its demise. Dissenters like the Yokleys avoided conflict with the Confederates only taking up arms when they needed to protect themselves or their family. In the aftermath of the war, however, numerous reasons existed to maintain the memory of dissent and create a cohesive Unionist identity. The Southern Claims Commission, which I mentioned earlier, bitterness over wartime mistreatment, and political fights pitting former Confederates against the Republican Party all encouraged the creation of a Unionist identity, inclusive of all dissenters. Premised upon a myth of principled Unionism, this identity flourished in the 1870s. The patriotism and uncompromising opposition to the Confederacy expressed in the claims of the Southern Claims Commission, though, were partially a product of government standards for proving Unionism. The enabling legislation for the Claims Commission ensured that claimants framed the retelling of their resistance around their love of Union, regardless of why they had done it. Because the government defined true resistance as being a product of patriotism, claimants stressed their political allegiance. Samuel Yokley testified using the languages of patriotism, but this close examination has shown us, again, that it's family and self-interest that are crucial. Encouraged, though, by newspapers and politics and pecuniary interests, uncompromising unionism, principled dissent, and patriotism became the standard means for describing dissenters' resistance. Unlike former Confederate soldiers who shared memories of battle and fighting for the lost cause, dissenters had trouble creating an analogous shared experience or shared memory because a narrative based on uncompromising unionism ignored the complexities of dissent and failed to fit the reality many dissenters remembered. Basing an identity on a myth of uncompromising principle required extreme massaging of individual memories for many dissenters. In this context, it was frequently easier to forget than remember. The Oakley's family demonstrates this. While Samuel Oakley's brother, Andrew, submitted a claim to the Southern Claims Commission, he declared, "I did all I could for the cause. I kept out of the army." Well, keeping out of the army was apparently the only thing he would do. He'd hired a substitute, hauled wood for the railroad, eventually hid in the woods. Unsurprisingly, his claim was denied. After the war, though, local definitions of unionism varied greatly from that of the federal government. Though the federal government required unwavering conviction, claimants throughout the 1870s insisted dissenters of all sorts were actually unionists. Though the government deemed Andrew disloyal, denying his claim for compensation, Samuel considered his brother to be a union man, asking him to testify as a witness in his own successful claim. Indeed, previously denied claimants frequently provided testimony for their neighbors' approved claims and vice versa. Approved claimants then considered many of their neighbors with denied claims to have been true union men, implying a disconnect between the government standard and a local standard. For many dissenters, serving on a detail hauling wood or paying for a substitute to fight in your place was no way antithetical to joining the Heroes of America, a loosely organized resistance network. What role the memories of wartime dissent played in the post-war life of individual dissenters frequently remains unclear. However, it seems likely that Samuel remained a lifelong Republican. His hatred for the Confederacy may well have been a constitutive part of his post-war sense of self. Or his anti-Confederate past may have played only a minor role in his post-bellum life, appearing only when it was useful in some manner. For example, when he testified before the Claims Commission. Given all he had suffered, though, we might assume he took great pride in his resistance and proudly identified as a unionist into old age. However, his family quickly forgot his Civil War suffering. The experiences of the family are suggestive, though not conclusive, of why dissent disappeared, why a memory of dissent is largely been forgotten in the Piedmont of North Carolina. Samuel's son David Yokley had been conscripted in August of 1862, but deserted a month later with his brother and uncle. And had taken up, either he or his brother had taken up arms to rescue the other one. Whether as captor of a rescuer, we know though that David certainly participated in the event on the road where deserters were freed. Despite these experiences, though, David Yokley does not appear to have been especially tied to the Union. His second marriage to a 16-year-old, born a decade after the war, endured until his death. What he told his young bride of the war remains unknown. However, it seems likely he failed to mention his wartime resistance. In a 1930s application for a pension based on David's Confederate service, his widow answered no to the question, "Was your late husband a deserter?" The application was denied, but only because she was 55 instead of the minimum of 60 required to be eligible. In fact, David's wartime dissent failed to deter even him from applying for a Confederate pension. Though in theory ineligible due to his desertion, not to mention his lack of service, David claimed to have been a loyal Confederate and received a pension until his death in 1926 for his 1 month of service. For $60 a year, David had erased his past. In the end, though, Unionist memory just failed to sustain a usable counter-narrative to the lost cause, as the post-war Unionist identity was built on unstable foundations. A dependency on patriotic motivations and a divided communities instead of shared experience, skin color, or geographic location created inherent weaknesses within a Unionist identity. Almost all Southern whites were welcome to share in the glories of the lost cause, but to be a white Unionist required uncompromising devotion and persecution by your neighbors. So not everyone can be accepted. According to the Lost Cause narrative, many dissenters had not even dissented. Deserters only left to provide for their families. Details provided important material support against overwhelming odds. And even fighting for the Union provided proof of one's manhood. Recusant conscripts remained the only category that really failed to have a place in the Lost Cause narrative. A As many historians have pointed out, the resurgence in Confederate memory from 1890 to 1920, visibly demonstrated by the erection of Confederate monuments across the South, corresponded to the rise of Jim Crow. Unionist memory failed to remain useful in the face of this. Increasingly, Confederate memory worked to unite whites along racial lines, celebrating the honor and bravery of the white race, while in contrast, Unionist memory continued to depend on a memory of division and persecution, thus dividing neighbors and even families. As the number of former dissenters decreased due to death and immigration, Democratic politicians too young to have fought presumably became more politically acceptable than their Confederate predecessors who Unionists refused to vote for. With the end of the Southern Claims Commission and the introduction of Confederate pensions, even the monetary incentive to celebrate dissent was replaced by a new motivation to proclaim a Confederate affiliation. Today, members of the Oakley family know nothing of their anti-Confederate roots. Samuel's son, Andrew, who died in federal service, was killed in an ambush in Missouri by Confederate guerrillas, thus linking it to all these other papers. Though the family had not known of his enlistment, the family had not known of his enlistment at all, or his death in U.S. service before the war, until after the war ended, Yoakley used his son's death in his Union Army as proof that he himself was a Unionist when he got his successful claim. Additionally, he collected his son's back pay, and his wife applied for her son's pension in 1884. Yet once the monetary incentive to remember disappeared, so did the memory of his sacrifice. In 1982, an amateur genealogist tracing her family's heritage recalled that Andrew supposedly died, and I quote, of a pistol wound reportedly inflicted by Jesse James while working with the Pony Express. Now, the Pony Express ceased operation in 1861, for those of you who don't know, 3 years before Andrew actually died, and Jesse James was barely 14 at the time. But instead of celebrating Andrew's devotion to Union, the family created a heroic story that disconnected his death from the war entirely. As historians increasingly look at the history of Unionism and dissent, studies of historical memory present a unique opportunity to understand the nature of dissent. Historians of this inner war, this guerrilla war that we've been talking about all week, should not neglect the creation and ultimate failure of Unionist counter-narratives. The Yoakleys embraced the identities of both Unionist and Confederate when convenient. The family vividly demonstrates that dissenters were not passive in the creation of an amnesia of dissent. And examining why the memory of the war not only provides insight into why Unionism was forgotten, but also displays the complexity of wartime loyalties. As was often the case in Piedmont, above all other loyalties, the Yoakleys were loyal to family. Thank you. Now we'll give it to the people who do remember guerrilla warfare.
I'll echo the thanks that Leonard and Adam gave to everyone at the Filson, everyone who's turned out. This is very impressive. 3 straight days of a packed house. This is almost unheard of for an academic conference. And I will also cite Aaron's NyQuil as an excuse for any missteps I make just because I don't have a better one. So I'm going to borrow his as well. So in the spring of 1905, Judge A.J. Little of Missouri receives a letter postmarked Lawrence, Kansas. Little is the elected captain of the Quantrill Men Survivor Association. He does not know the letter's sender, but that sender, who happens to be a disgruntled Union veteran from Kansas named Jones, knows Little and his comrades quite well. So I'm going to read you an extract from this letter. I would suggest that you hold your next annual reunion at Lawrence, Kansas, and join with members of the 7th Kansas Cavalry, this is Jennison's Jayhawkers, in celebrating Quantrill's last raid across the Kansas border. If you still have any fight left in you and desire to settle old scores, we will be perfectly willing to bring our trusty carbines along and join you in a little match. The grandchildren of those whom Quantrill murdered at Lawrence, the letter concluded, would be present and would no doubt enjoy the fun hugely. Now, Little does not dispatch a reply, and the former guerrillas of William Clark Quantrill's command, still notorious because of the last time we coalesced in Lawrence, they wisely opt not to hold their reunion on Kansas soil. Now, During the war, irregulars, like Tobey Maguire, they go by many names. So we're guerrillas, we're bushwhackers, we're Jayhawkers, Redlegs, Raiders, Home Guard. In the guerrilla theater they occupy, the back roads, the hamlets, the households of the home front are replacing standard battlefields and war departments. This touches a lot on what Leanne spoke about Thursday evening. All manner of violent encounters, ambush, arson, rape, murder, massacre, torture, these things are taking the place of Napoleonic maneuvers and the pitched battles we typically associate with the war. We have family fighting against family, neighbor taking up arms against neighbor. The Civil War is taking on very local, almost hyper-personal qualities as it unfolds at a community level. Now, with this brutal legacy in mind, and given the hostilities that are still apparently lingering along the border in 1905, it might come as a surprise that Jones's invitation didn't trigger something akin to middle-aged bushwhackers gone wild. But the Quantrill Association cannot afford to make a national incident. And this is because the reunions that they are organizing annually, that the rest of this talk will be about, they're components of a very specific commemorative agenda. So ex-bushwhackers are in the midst of a self-prescribed image overhaul. This is an overhaul designed to reboot how Missouri's pro-Confederate guerrillas should and would be remembered in the 20th century South. Now, in recent years, and other people have touched on a few of these scholars, so we won't go too in-depth, a lot of scholarly attention has been paid to commemorative ceremonies. It's increased dramatically as time goes on. So from David Blight and Barbara Gannon to Carrie Janey and Stuart McConnell, historians have explored the various ways in which Northern and Southern veterans organizations used reunions to either welcome or ward off sectional reconciliation, to regulate racial controls on white society, or to cope with unprecedented trauma, destruction, and death. I am staring at Megan Kate Nelson as I describe those things. So despite this academic fascination with the Civil War generation's physical rituals of remembrance, we've actually paid little attention to guerrillas. Toby is sort of getting the shaft in this arrangement, but more importantly, we've been ignoring what reunions of the Quantrill Band, what getting the band back together, ultimately tells us about how seemingly static memory narratives, things we just assume are conceived whole and then remembered, how they actually evolve over time, and perhaps more importantly, how the commemorative rituals associated with guerrilla memory lay bare a post-war environment that is deeply fractured by contested notions of whiteness itself and Southern identity. Now, I've argued elsewhere, and some of you have suffered through that talk even in this room, that throughout the late 1860s and much of the 1870s, an ex-Confederate cavalryman turned Democratic fire eater named John Newman Edwards. If you're familiar with some of the Jesse James lore, you have probably read something concocted by the major. He constructs an irregular lost cause for the state of Missouri. So he's fearing that the state's failure to secede from the Union is going to isolate it from the rest of the pro-Democrat South in the post-war period. In other words, Edward wants to ensure that a lack of Confederate credentials will not preclude the state from a post-war Southern identity. So what does Edwards do? He wields the state's best known wartime export, the guerrilla, and he just fabricates those credentials. Because when you're a newspaper editor in the 1870s, you can do that. So through a series of popular editorials and later a book, he's going to lay the groundwork for a mythological narrative that would tout Missouri's guerrillas and their horses as the most diehard of all Confederate warriors and simultaneously detach them from the failed Confederate state. This was the beauty of being an irregular. You could fight hard, but you didn't have to absorb the loss. So through a model of guerrilla honor that's based on localized killing efficiency and justified homicide, Edwards is trying to transform men like Jake Rodell, William Quantrill, Bloody Bill Anderson, who incidentally dies tomorrow, 150 years later, Cole Younger, and both of the James brothers, Frank and Jesse, into wartime folk heroes. But here's where the rub comes in, because by the turn of the century, Edwards is long dead, and his platform has essentially worked. The Democratic Party has regained a firm hold on politics in Missouri. So as the partisan usefulness of Edwards' original irregular loss cause dwindles, so too does its value as social and cultural currency to the Quantrill men. In response, with their own obsolescence basically hanging in the balance here, they're going to employ commemorative activities as a way to disconnect themselves from the original Edwards narrative and find a more lasting, enduring place for themselves in mainstream Southern society. So the chapter that this talk is culled from addresses that shift, how the Quantrill men go about establishing this sort of memorial foothold using very public reunions. Here is one. I love this kid. He is ready to just reignite border hostilities. How do we go about establishing this foothold? We have annual reunions from 1898 to 1929. Now, doing so requires them to borrow themes from both the Lost Cause, which is a memory movement, and the New South, which is more of an economic booster movement. These things, we're talking about allegiance to the Democratic Party, sectional reconciliation, the roles of women as the guardians of Confederate heritage, the proper place of African Americans in Southern society, and how best to interact with veterans of subsequent foreign conflicts, because of this, of course, in this period, as Aaron pointed out this morning, we're getting more and more veterans. There's only so much of the commemorative pie. Eventually, we've got to start sharing these pieces. To be clear, by borrowing themes from these movements, I mean to say that ex-guerrillas cherry-picked ideas from either whenever or wherever it suited their agenda, regardless of whether or not the broader goals of those movements conflicted, because, of course, we know they often did. Now, I'm going to operate under the assumption that most of you dutifully read through the full version of the essay, wink, considering its length and, frankly, the dubious reputation of its author, this might be a stretch. But if you did read the full piece, you hopefully saw very clearly how guerrilla reunions are courting a specific type of African-American visitor, how they're paying homage to women as gatekeepers of the Lost Cause, how they tout the merits of sectional reconciliation to a degree, and, most importantly, how they try to graciously set their own legacies apart from veterans of the Spanish-American War and World War I. If you didn't have a chance to read the full paper, trust me, I'm wearing a bow tie. I would not lead you astray. Now, today we're going to focus on two incidents from the 1904 and the 1907 reunions of the Quantrill Association. One involves a political speech gone awry. The other, we'll just throw it out there, an attempted homicide over a confiscated pet raccoon. You heard that right. Taken together, these incidents will reveal how association members prioritize their commemorative agenda above all else, and they'll underscore how strictly ex-bushwhackers are regulating their collective image as staunch Southern Democrats. In turn, I'm hoping this comparison will also shed light on what could happen to Quantrill men who stray from the plan to integrate guerrilla memory back into the bounds of conventional remembrance. Just to give you some quick background information, guerrilla reunions typically mirror a reunion held by regular veterans in the late 19th or the early 20th centuries. Everyone, I'm sure, has seen the Gettysburg encampments. They're sort of like that, just on a much smaller scale. Festivities often include hundreds, sometimes even thousands, of spectators. They involve parades, picnic lunches, ice cream socials, political speeches, all that fun stuff. Now, most of the Quantrill men are in their late 50s and early 60s at the turn of the century when these reunions begin. They're slightly younger than their counterparts from the regular war, and it's important to note that reunions are heavily reported on by local, regional, and even national newspapers. Word of these is traveling as far as Boston, the Dakotas. It's all over the place. So this is the scene in 1904 when Frank James, I'm sorry, I don't have Jesse for you, we just have Frank, a former bushwhacker turned bandit and Jesse's brother, learned the hard way that the association would censor anyone who broke from protocol in front of the public, or more importantly, in front of the news media. Frank makes a boo-boo. So James has been invited to speak before the group about old times. He's supposed to sort of recount what it was like in the glory days of Quantrill's band, and as one newspaper put it, ended up exploding a political bombshell that all but disrupted the meeting. Hang on to that. That all but disrupted the meeting. This is going to be important a little bit later. In recent years, right around the turn of the century, James had made no secret of his displeasure with the Democrat-controlled state legislature in Missouri. In 1900, it had chosen not to elect him to the honorary position of doorman of the lower house. So he literally was not the guy who got to open the door for everyone. Disgruntled by this perceived major slight, James took his opportunity to speak at the reunion to launch into a political tirade that ended with his defection to the Republican Party and a promise before all to vote for Theodore Roosevelt. This outburst, according to another paper, was, quote, considered by the grizzled, war-scarred veterans as little less than treason. Now, at this point in the story, especially after what we heard from Joe's panel and then the Kentucky panel yesterday, it's not hard to imagine people reaching for belly guns and boot knives. This was not the crowd you wanted to go Republican in front of. Some of James's more level-headed comrades forcibly drag him from the rostrum out of the crowd as tensions start to flare. Had they not, another paper opines, quote, it might have been the scene of another conflict recalling the border days. Now, we're going to fast forward to the 1907 reunion, and coverage from the Kansas City Post recalls that in 1863, Dave Edwards and Jim Cummins, quote, fought side by side under the leadership of the famous Confederate Charles Quantrill. But, this is Cummins in sort of a stylized version that he had done of himself. According to eyewitnesses who were actually at the 1907 reunion, when Edwards caught sight of Cummins enjoying a picnic lunch, he produced a revolver from his hip pocket, approached Cummins, and shot at him from roughly 3 feet. Now, time had apparently eroded Edwards' fighting prowess. The bullet tears a hole in Cummins' coat and hits a bystander in the foot. With the help of a few men, the local marshal seizes Edwards, they wrestle the gun away, and he is arrested. Now we'll do the story behind this story, and this is going to be our only in Missouri moment for the day. So the previous October, Edwards and Cummins had lived together at Higginsville, which is essentially the Confederate home for veterans in western Missouri. Now, during his time at Higginsville, Edwards was the proud parent of a pet raccoon. It lives with him in his room. One day, he discovers the animal missing from his room and immediately believes that Cummins, who is a former member of the James Younger gang, has taken the animal. He blames Cummins, though why Cummins might have wanted the raccoon was never fully explained. So, according to Edwards' version of the events, he accuses Cummins and, quote, Cummins grew very angry at the accusation and threatened to beat me to death. The pet raccoon was never recovered. Edwards decides to take justice into his own hands. Not to skew you to one side or the other in the debate, but 2 years later, Cummins actually did beat another resident of Higginsville to death with his cane in a separate argument. Now, attempted homicide in the middle of a busy, it's basically a fair-like environment. These reunions would seem like a very serious black eye for the Quantrill men, but the other ex-guerrillas nor their guests thought so. Oh, it's nothing. I turned to see who was fighting and then went on about my business, announced one female witness. Another flatly declared that, quote, it didn't amount to anything. The old men just had a quarrel. Even the newspaper noted nonchalantly, quote, the shooting would have broken up almost any other picnic, but the veterans of the Quantrill raids, their wives and daughters, forgot all about it in 15 minutes and went about their merrymaking. Frank James plugs TR. He's dragged from the crowd before he's lynched. We have an attempted homicide, and 15 minutes later, all is well at the reunion. Now, by modern standards of behavior, at least I hope so, Frank James's oratorical misstep and Cummins' narrow escape from a bullet hardly seem comparable. At first glance, I feel a little ridiculous actually juxtaposing them for you. But in the context of turn-of-the-century memory politics, the James incident is a very serious issue for ex-guerrillas, one that has to be handled with the care of a full-on scandal. So while Edwards had attempted to murder another reunion attendee over a pet raccoon, James had publicly called out the Democratic Party. He joined the likes of Longstreet and Mosby in defecting to the Republicans, and he'd risked estranging the rest of Quantrill's command from the South's dominant political entity. At the same time, he risked estranging them from the other mainstream Southerners who kept that entity rolling. So, in terms of consequences, Frank James is going to fare the worst. At the 1905 reunion, it was made clear that he was no longer welcome to attend meetings of the Quantrill men. He is effectively banished from the group. He is cut off like an infected limb that threatens to destroy the rest of the body. Where is Brian Craig Miller when you need him, right? Moreover, even with James barred from the next reunion, the association's officers decided that there would be no political speeches made that year. The dust of James's outburst had just settled, and the group could not risk another publicized political gaffe. The politicians come back in 1906, but Frank James remains on what is essentially double-secret probation for several years. For his part, Dave Edwards faces no charges, formal or otherwise. Cummins decided not to prosecute his would-be assassin, and Edwards was allowed to attend all subsequent association functions until his death in 1916. So again, you make a speech, you're banished, you try to kill somebody, you're back in the fold. Now, despite their best efforts, reunions of the Quantrill men mostly fail to accomplish the end goal that we talked about at the beginning of the paper. These meetings have been organized by ex-guerrillas to help refurbish their commemorative credentials and to help ensure that they would be remembered alongside their regular counterparts in the 20th century. So in short, when the viability of one memory narrative ran dry, ex-guerrillas utilized reunions to construct and employ another. As you'll note from the full version of the essay, wink again, these meetings did not unfold in a vacuum. The campaign to reboot guerrilla memory had multiple prongs. We have multiple moving parts. So during virtually the same 30-year window that these reunions are happening, former bushwhackers are also penning memoirs, and they are propagating many of the same themes and ideas that we see at reunions. It's probably safe to say that reunions actually serve as an outlet for the Quantrill men to physically act out the identities they recreate for themselves on paper in person. So these go together pretty well. But unlike the printed word, real-time encounters, these reunions, require constant planning, organization, maintenance, and above all else, attendance. So this was the 1911 reunion. Less than a decade later, this is what's left. You have to have attendance to keep the cogs of the memory machine turning. So for these reasons, guerrilla reunions ultimately lack the endurance of a published memoir or even physical activities carried out by a larger group, and they must ultimately be deemed less effective instruments of long-horizon memory shaping. Now, this is actually, it's probably worth pointing out, this is Jesse James Jr. So this tells you how old the rest of these guys are by 1920. So to end with the failings of guerrilla reunions would be selling rather short their broader importance, both to how we understand guerrilla memory in the 20th century and as a lens to the broader intersection of memory and identity politics in the post-war South. On one side, we see the process through which memory narratives have literally been designed, created, destroyed, and updated. On another, we see through the existence of an entire commemorative agenda rooted in irregular warfare that Americans had to play the commemorative cards dealt them by the war. So put another way, they had to deal with remembering the war as they'd experienced it, and those experiences vary dramatically more than most national accounts of Civil War memory currently even begin to suggest. On still another side, the fact that ex-guerrillas even believed that such lengths were necessary to ensure their acceptance in post-war Southern society should raise serious red flags. Eminent accounts of Civil War memory have essentially conceded that white sectional reconciliation comes at the expense of emancipation-centric legacies of the war. So in effect, the white side of the color line, especially in the South, quickly re-solidifies and uniformly vests itself in a memorial platform based on mutual valor and shared sacrifice, sort of the battles and leaders rah-rah version of the war. But in closing, the motive and the intent lurking beneath these reunions should shed light on a vastly more complicated and ultimately divided scenario. As the Quantrill men and their efforts, I hope, show, generic Confederate sympathies, and most of all whiteness, simply weren't enough to guarantee remembrance at a time when one's role in the war, which is still the defining event of a generation, still meant everything. Thank you very much. And go Gators. What was that about?
I'm a bitter man. A commentator for this panel this morning is Barton Myers. He's assistant professor of history at Washington and Lee University. He earned his PhD from the University of Georgia in 2009. He's the author of Rebels Against the Confederacy, North Carolina's Unionist, which was published this fall. Is it out already?
It is.
Is that cool? By Cambridge University Press, and Executing Daniel Bright, Race, Loyalty, and Guerrilla Violence in a Coastal Carolina Community, 1861-1865, which was published by Louisiana State University Press in 2009. He's also the author of a number of articles and book chapters, but you want to hear him talk and not me talk about him. So,
I want to reiterate thanking everyone that organized the conference, Glenn, Mark, Leanne, and Aaron. I'll try to keep my comments short, but rather traditional in terms of commenting on three very good papers, and three very humorous papers, I might add. A little humor into the irregular war this morning. Leonard Lanier rightly highlights the intense competition between North Carolinians and Virginians in the early years of the Lost Cause myth formation, demonstrating that veterans and politicians from both states still viewed the Civil War as a contested past in the first decade of the 20th century. Supremacy in the Lost Cause was on the line, and North Carolinians were working overtime to compete with Virginia. Especially on the key points of who charged farthest at Gettysburg on the afternoon of July 3rd, 1863, and who made the last breakout attempt at Appomattox in April 1865. Lanier's paper ably investigates the connection of North Carolina politician J. Bryan Grimes in the dedication of the North Carolina Appomattox Monument, and in particular his efforts to preserve the memory of his own father, Confederate General Bryan Grimes, and his role in the Confederate War. Now, General Bryan Grimes had been the leader of the final assault that many North Carolinians now claimed as last at Appomattox, but he left behind a complicated legacy for his children. An unpopular political general during the war, failed politician in Reconstruction, and a leading member of North Carolina's Ku Klux Klan, who was subsequently murdered. His family, especially his wife Charlotte and Democratic friend J.J. Laughinghouse, repackaged him as a Confederate military hero, the quote-unquote Ivanhoe of Pitt County, in the wake of his murder. All in a state that lacked the pantheon of Virginia notables, which made construction of Lost Cause mythology much easier, where Confederate generals were already widely regarded as heroes. Leonard, I wonder if you might contextualize Grimes inside other families from North Carolina and their attempts to resurrect the memory and repackage less successful and controversial Confederates. This is, I think, a promising line of inquiry for a lot of different states, but North Carolina in particular, into how the Lost Cause is formed from the bottom up by individuals at the state level. A comparison of other similar individuals and families' reclamation projects could make a really promising book, I think. The examination of the role of political feuding in the Reconstruction period and its intersection with memory is a great value of this piece as well, especially in a region divided politically during the war, as Adams' paper has shown us. North Carolina did not have a deep bench of living or dead successful Confederate generals to draw upon for myth construction. And does this explain why they ultimately lose the battle for supremacy in the Lost Cause myth in its competition with Virginia and other places? Was it also a lack of resources and control of institutions like the Southern Historical Society papers that Virginians largely gained control over, memory at the national level? North Carolinians are publishing, but where are they publishing, in other words, this myth construction? I'd also like to see slightly more on assessing Grimes as a combat commander in the piece, which would help understand his later legacy as well. Further discussion of his political machinations during the war would also help us understand the general and his meaning to the later Lost Cause production in North Carolina. And at the local level in Pitt and Beaufort counties, further explication of their Lost Cause memories of Grimes, their construction of Grimes, a sort of alternative view of him, other events during the war would help finish contextualizing the role of Grimes as a product of the local, state, and national Lost Cause movements. Move on to our second panelist. Adam Dombey's insightful paper moves us to the Piedmont interior of North Carolina to focus on a different type of Civil War legacy and collection of memory stories. Dombey's look at the inner Civil War of Davidson and Forsyth counties, the memory of desertion and dissent, and specifically the life of militant white farmer Samuel Yokley, reminds us just how much of our Civil War has been lost and needs to be recovered. Dombey's careful use of Southern Claims Commission records, pension records, and other accounts, and very ably done, Adam, demonstrates a way for us to piece together, however incompletely, the stories of those Southerners Carl Daigler referred famously to as the Other South. For Dombey, Samuel Yokley fits into the class of small slaveholders who worried about the institution's future and their own economic fortunes if war went against a new Confederacy. His opposition to secession grew out of those beliefs and fears. Dombey accurately displays the importance of Confederate conscription in pushing many of these people into public confrontation. Now, Yokley's violent resistance emerged as a result of threats to his sons by Confederate officials enforcing the policy. And this certainly was the trigger from peaceful to violent forms of resistance for some elements among the resistant population. An unpopular Confederacy was now using force, and force became a response among a diverse array of resistant people. Dombey accurately highlights that local and family concerns were what pushed some into armed resistance to the Confederacy, but that the fall of the Confederacy was never a reasonable military aim for them at the personal level. In other words, this was not a coordinated insurgency. In fact, it's a very poor term to use to describe guerrilla warfare in this region. It was a local war of self-protection, of family protection. They awaited liberation at the hands of the Union Army, ultimately, in this particular irregular war within the larger Civil War. Now, Dombey argues that after the war, a Unionist counter-narrative does not emerge to counter the Lost Cause myth because, quote-unquote, a narrative of uncompromising Unionism ultimately failed to adequately contain the experiences of dissenters. But few of those dissenters even attempted to create a unified narrative in written form. Their resistance, which partially explains its absence from any grand narrative or subsequent counter-narrative production. Unionism's memory was frequently an oral tradition, and by its nature, fractured and episodic, passed down from one family member to another, or, as Adam shows us, not passed down in some cases, or passed down in odd ways in some other cases. But Unionism also involved Unionists who were women. They were elderly, Black, underage. They were silent or were never drawn into open confrontation over the issue of conscription as well. Open confrontation that made principled Unionism an even more difficult story to tell later on after the war, or to tell even amongst people that were Unionists. Dissidents frequently told their stories after the war to each other, but they were fractured in their discussions of this and rarely had a megaphone loud enough to overcome, even at the local level, historical myth production of the ex-Confederate majority. Why use the phrase collective amnesia when other descriptions and explanations are more precise for why this process of erasure takes place in a Confederate state, both locally at the hands of Confederates and by the diverse dissident population themselves? In addition to other issues highlighted, violent, malignant erasure at the hands of Zebulon Vance, the war governor, of the South, or the war governor of North Carolina, depending on how you see him, and others, was at the least part of the problem of any unionist counter-narrative emerging. Dombey uses dissenter in place of unionist, which he rightly rightly argues implies a political ideology, or political ideologies, even. But it remains unclear what Dombey believes a unionist ideology or ideologies looked like during the war, in this piece in particular. At one point, he suggests principled unionism may be a myth created in the post-war largely by the SEC and its extremely high standards of evaluation. Just like a little more comment on that. Not every Southerner defined union in the same way. For some, unionism meant the economic safety of the antebellum protection of slavery, because the union had always protected the institution. Finally, how does the meaning of dissenter highlight something new for us or differ from the broad category anti-Confederate, which Dombey also uses, which others such as William Freeling have very, very carefully defined for us, and have used to explore a broad range of resistant elements within the Confederacy that were not hardcore unionists? In particular, a discussion of how Dombey's terminology and notion of political ideology relate to Freeling's anti-Confederate category would be beneficial to the reader. Our third panelist. Like Dombey's piece, Matt Hulbert's examination of Missouri post-war guerrilla reunions presents another important facet of Civil War memory creation from the realm of guerrilla conflict. Hulbert argues that men from William Clark Quantrill's band and other bushwhackers are in the process of reshaping their image in the early 20th century. He argues that the process of memory creation among these men highlight contested notions of whiteness and Southern identity. Hulbert believes that many former guerrillas were actively distancing themselves from earlier mythical notions of the quote-unquote noble guerrilla promoted by men like John Newman Edwards, Democratic journalist, Missouri Lost Cause myth promoter. He describes this process as gaining a quote-unquote memorial foothold through public commemoration. He argues that these men in their 50s and 60s borrowed liberally from the larger Lost Cause memory movement and New South economic movement to create the image and space for themselves. He argues ultimately that their reunions are largely unsuccessful at reconfiguring the Lost Cause myth in Missouri, or even at the local level in any region of the state. So, Matt, why do these men care about their public reputation at this point in their lives, in their 50s and 60s? Does their age have something to do with it? More broadly, do reunions from the irregular wars shape the national Lost Cause mythology in any way? Do they have any effect at the national level at all? Was it the level of violence and atrocity, their behavior during the war, alone that prevented them from reasserting their importance, or was it the dominance of other regions and stories in that narrative? Do they participate in writing the Southern Historical Society papers at all, for example? Do they contribute, or other Lost Cause publications? How do other leaders in the irregular wars, John Mosby, for example, despite becoming Republican, go down as Confederate heroes, not villains in the Confederate pantheon of the Lost Cause? In other words, is there some sort of Eastern theater bias even in the realm of guerrilla memory that you're talking about here? And I'd like you to just comment a little more on that. But one of the things that I think comes off our final panel yesterday that I really want to bring back in here is maybe Lieber. Do these men ever reevaluate themselves in light of changes to the laws of war? Are they ever self-reflective on the morality of the conflict, or talk about how laws of war related to what they do in their 50s and 60s? Do they reflect on that? One thing is clear from this panel's selection of papers. Wars, regular and irregular, produce fractured and episodic memories, partial and often manipulated for public consumption afterward. Understanding those local and subordinate memory narratives remains one of the most promising new areas for the subfield of Civil War memory study, and I thank all three of your panelists for pushing us in new directions. Thank you very much. We can take questions.
Joe.
Martin, thank you for the comment. That was great. I have a question for the gentleman who both died. Matt, it seems like these guys, when they're memorializing, commemorating, they continue to be bushwhackers. They're very flexible in how they go about doing this, their strategy, their tactics. Does the way that they memorialized the war tell us anything about who they were during the war?
Yes, I think this actually gets to the last question Barton asked about whether or not Quantrillmen actually reevaluate themselves in the process of trying to remake how they remember. And the short answer is no, they do not. They never technically apologize or re-remember what they did. They're essentially trying to sort of make over how you will remember what they did. So it's not a, we are sort of conceding that these larger national currents of memory, sort of, you know, the battles and leaders, the mutual valor, we're not actually changing what we did. We're just kind of trying to show you why we fit there. But we'll never sort of go back and say, well, we were kind of lining up. We were like regular troops. No, they're bushwhackers through and through. That's why they're the Quantrillmen.
I have a question about the dissenters. You mentioned that a lot of them helped escape prisoners, and it's interesting because in escape prisoners' diaries or narratives that they write immediately after the war, they comment on their time with these people in North Carolina, that they loved the old flag, that they thought just what we thought, and it was great to spend the night with people who were just like us, only they were Southerners. Do you think that these escaped prisoners just missed what these people really believed? How do you interpret their view of these people's unionism?
It's a really good question. I think, in part, what's going on there is that a lot of times by the time these prisoners are getting there, you're talking about 1864, 1863, the earliest, really, that you have prisoners starting to show up in North Carolina. And so at this point, these folks really are a big fan of the North. They want the North to get there because they're getting shot. They're not only, when they're hiding these prisoners of war, frequently these prisoners of war are not hiding alone in the barn. Right next to them is the guy's son who's hiding from the conscription agents. So I think by that point, there is a very pro-union ideology. And ideology is always related. I mean, when you have ideology, it's always related to what happens, right? I mean, so I think that a lot of these guys do come out of the war feeling very strongly in favor of the union. I think it breeds it in a way that you could argue that in many ways the Confederacy creates unionists in much of the of North Carolina. If that answers your question.
Yes, sir.
Yes. Native North Carolina, we had that conversation yesterday, so very thrilled, but also a son of the Piedmont, and very familiar with the story of descent. What strikes me, first of all, is I've always thought North Carolina and Kentucky are basically opposite sides of the same coin, so we should put together a book. Essays on North Carolina and Kentucky in the Long War, something like that. Anyway, just an idea. But the that tension in North Carolina, I don't know whether some of this audience quite realizes just how much the Confederacy constructs and other North Carolina from early on in the war, especially with the specter of the draft and all of these things. You have a lot of dissent, so much so that you actually have an opposition party emerging to run against Vance in, 64? And definitely an anti-Confederate opposition political party. So I think focusing on that at the community level is a really important part of building that story. Obviously, there's work been done on this before and on the heroes of America, right? Yeah.
But yeah, thank you for your comments. First off, we should definitely talk about getting put together. That sounds great. Because I actually have a lot on that, and I think you're right about the community being key at the community level. I mean, my larger project, my dissertation, is three communities across in different states, and North Carolina is very distinct in the way that after the war, or I should say Forsyth County, which is a direct focus, is very distinct in the way that locally the memory of dissent does play a major role in politics. And it's you don't see that in Northern Virginia necessarily or in Georgia, where my other two communities are, but you do see they literally are talking at Republican rallies. They're talking about the five guys who get murdered in the last days of the war by the sharpshooters. This comes up, they're saying you can't vote for these Democrats because they're the same people who shot your sons. And so for me, and it's related back to Bart's comments, which I really appreciate, by the way. They're great. I think you're right that the term collective amnesia is a problematic one in the case of many communities. I think in the case of Forsyth, I might be overstating it, but I think there is an element where there is a memory created for a short period that does have political viability and political power that is lost. I think you're right, though, that it's not necessarily the individual stories that are getting passed on. It's specifically the we were persecuted, that guy persecuted us, instead of the individual of I did this and I did this and I did this for the union. So.
Bob.
T.J. Styles would roll his eyes at this question. You might see that. Could there be, I'm thinking back to that quote from the famous Richard Wire article, that Frank James was supposedly quoted in 1895 as predicting an eventual war between labor and capital. And more, I'm shorthanding here. And he would, of course, oppose capital. And Richard White assumes that this means a certain thing about him having been a Hobsbawmian social bandit or something during the war. And of course, I believe you and Stiles have done a pretty good job of saying, well, no, that's probably not true. However, I have to wonder, though, if Frank James's political turn 8 or so years later might have been based on something more than just hurt feelings that haven't been overlooked by the General Assembly of Missouri, especially when you come along with this political candidate who would have had appeal to someone who wanted to bridge the gap between this growing rift that you see in populist America in the 1890s.
There's some, I won't roll my eyes. TJ can roll his eyes, I won't do it. There's a tendril of connection there, though. At the same time, this is happening with James, his sort of defection to the Republican Party, because this is a thing, it really only happens in name. He's gone for 5 or 6 years. He eventually is welcomed back. And it's sort of swept into the rug, Frank's a Democrat, he's back with us. At the same time that saga is unfolding, he and Cole Younger are also mismanaging a Wild West show that travels the country. He literally is just so hard up for money that he will do anything. He essentially sells out his own Civil War credentials to say, of course I was in the Wild West fighting Mexican bandits and Indians, robbing stagecoaches in Nevada. So I don't know if it's so much a case of he's sort of a disgruntled proponent of labor as he just is disgruntled labor.
And of course, Charles Portis makes brief mention of that in the last chapter of True Grit.
Megan?
My question is also for Matt. I'm obsessed with those photographs of the reunions, especially since the second one you showed has that looming woman in white at the apex, which is just awesome. And the fact that they're holding the painting of Quantrill. And so it's this double visual image, and I think I was struck because most of the time we see guerrilla images from the war itself, they're individual photographs. And so my question for you, well, it's kind of twofold, but they're both about photos. One is, did these guerrilla groups ever take group photographs during the war? Or is this a sort of function of the reunion where they're trying to create an identity that is not individual, but group-oriented? And then, do you have any sense of how those photographs circulated? Were they kind of printed in newspapers? Did the guerrillas kind of have copies of these and put them in their scrapbooks? Like, how did that actually work?
So, to take the second question first, the photographs are specifically taken for newspaper circulation, so they do end up in national papers. The colorized image that was on the title page was actually a postcard that you could buy and send. That's the only reason it's actually survived. That one was not printed in newspapers. I think you're correct. I think they are taking these images, basically, you know, the yearbook, short people kneel in front. They're taking these images to sort of foster a collective identity. We are a group. This is the way we sort of unify and present the united front in terms of how it should be remembered. During the war,
gallery. We walk around.
They take a photo every year. They hold the Quantrill portrait every year. The photo stays. The ghost woman who you referenced in the picture is Lizzie Wallace. She hosts about two-thirds of the reunions at her home in Cross Grove. The mythology was that Quantrill saved her father from a Union home guard, literally cut him out of the tree. So then she is forever grateful and hosts them at the reunions. And she is sort of a specter in the back of that photograph, which is not a little ironic because at that point there are maybe 14 of them left and they are just sort of gradually fading away.
Aaron?
So Linda, you made a comment about trying to organize this. I'm glad that we landed it as a Civil War panel. It seems to me, and so I want to get your response to this, that it could easily have been a panel about the New South and about the degree of political division in the New South. I mean, a standing shibboleth of the creation of the New South is that Confederate identity sort of anneals whatever class divisions or ethnic or regional tensions are at play, and that whatever else happens, and this is Woodward, all of the classics that say that cultural identity melds those people together. But there's a surprising amount of post-war dissent rooted partly in memories of the war and of how you fight. That's a pretty robust challenge, particularly to the recent memory studies that have all basically assumed kind of uniformity among white Southerners. I mean, the dissent to that has been among white Northerners, but you all are challenging a different part of that that's in some ways more secure. Hopefully not for long.
Yeah, I definitely say that there is, we've created kind of this faux monolith of Confederate identity. And it really, and I think Barton alluded to this in the comments on my paper, it really varies, in my opinion, it varies from state to state how Confederate identity is constructed. And how in North Carolina, where you have a state where there's so much dissent, and there's also no overwhelming Confederate pantheon that emerges out of the war. So, for instance, in like Virginia in 1880, when the Democrats need somebody with a Confederate, ethos to run against the readjusters, they of course go to Lee. They find Fitzhugh, they run him. In North Carolina, when the populist movement begins, then the Democrats want to use try to sell the whole Confederate ideology problem. They never really find anybody that they can use, all like the Virginians. That's why they eventually have to resort, in my mind, to a little bit more overt white supremacist logic to defeat populism in North Carolina as opposed to elsewhere in the South. It really does vary from state to state depending on the internal divisions within the state during the war and then the divisions after the war, and the lack or the presence thereof of some kind of Confederate ideology that is surmount amongst the elite within that state. And North Carolina doesn't have that. They try to construct it, and they kind of create something, but they don't really, it's hard to make Zebulon Vance a champion of the Confederacy.
Any further questions? Well, thank you all for coming. I appreciate it.